So Howard, tell me then, where were you born? Where did you grow up?
I was born in a little village further up the Rhymney Valley called Pentoyn. And I was 4 or 5 months old when we moved from there. It was after the war, Bargoed, where they built a new housing estate of steel houses. And we were one of the first people family in there, because I'm one of 7 children, 5 boys, 2 girls, and my mother and father. And my father was working in the mines. And I was about 4 or 5 months old. There I am, there, la.
Oh, a picture you pointed to. Yeah. Oh, nice, yeah. That's your mum?
No, it's my sister.
Oh, your sister.
And my older sister.
So did you go to school?
Yeah, in Bargoed, yeah.
What was school like?
Well, I was infant school. All right, yeah, you know. Quite, well, I didn't know a lot about it because my mother and father always spoke Welsh. And we spoke Welsh. But when we went to school, we had to speak English. Because there was a lot of the teachers were older generation after the war. No young teachers there. And we had to speak English. Well, you know, I got a lot confused about it. Like, you know what I mean? Well, I can't remember it all, but, you know.
What was your secondary school?
Bargoed North. Bargoed South and Bargoed North, and secondary modern school. And that's where I went to infant school first, then Bargoed South, and then Bargoed North.
And how did school go for you?
Yeah, all right. You know, I never had any qualifications or anything. I just couldn't wait because I was in such a big family. So all I wanted to do was get out and work to earn money, you know what I mean? With my mother and father, because my brothers were getting married, my sisters were getting married, and I just felt I wanted to contribute, you know, and that's right then. As you say, my father knew a manager of the local emporium, Maypole supermarket opened in Bargoed, and my father talked to him. He said, send him down to me, he said. So off I done and started as an apprentice butcher.
How long were you there for?
I was there about six, seven months. Or maybe a bit less than that. And he found out that there was a butcher on myself. And there wasn't enough customers to verify me working. You know, the butcher could manage on his own there. So what I done, I went across the road to the other butcher, another butcher's in Woodleys, and I had a job there. So I stayed there a few months, and Bob's your uncle, I went to the pits. Worked, done my training in Bargoed Colliery, and worked in a coal mine then for a few months. And I seen a man have his leg off, and I said, whoa, what's going on here? So anyway, cut a long story short, it hit me, you know, and it's, was carrying him out, and I thought, well, I know what I'm going to do now. When you see something like that, it's, you know, at such a young age, and I said, oh, I decided then to join the army. So I went on a Saturday morning down to the recruiting office in Cardiff and joined up.
Just thinking about life in the colliery now. How old were you when you first went underground?
Well, what was it? I was 16, I think, 16 and a half. You know, like that. And when I finished then, and I was 17, and then that's when I joined the army.
Tell me, what was your routine, normal working day in the colliery as a 16-year-old?
Well, I put with a repairer, a senior man, They were short of repairers, and a repairer means if you have old workings and they're caving in, you have to go and clean all that out, but put new rings up and laggings and above the roof, or do different things. And you know, he was there to train me as a repairer. And you could go anywhere, you could go anywhere in the pit, and you know, if something falling or whatever, it was getting a bit dodgy, you'd have to go in there and clear it all out and repair the roof.
And what was conditions like?
Well, it was very dusty, because these old workings had been there 40, 60, 80 years, and the dust was there, and when you were pulling it down, it was very dusty, you know, and do different things.
Was it hazardous?
Oh yeah, you had to watch your step. You just couldn't go in and relax it easy, because you had to keep your eye on, well, you kept an eye on each other. And if you heard something creaking or cracking, you sort of say, whoa, get back. And within a couple of minutes or 10 minutes, you'd have a roof fall or whatever, you know.
Did you enjoy that work?
Yeah, I did. It was, what can I say? It was an experience. Because you knew then, with that, when you first started off, the different noises, and you can hear creaking or cracking and that, and you know, there's something, you know, something gonna happen. Because you take it, when you remove the ground from underneath, that roof is all stone above you, and it was creaking and cracking and, you know, pushing down on the rings.
But that life wasn't for you.
It was, to a certain extent. But as I say, I seen this guy have his leg off with a machine, with a coal cutting machine, and it really, well, I'd say frightened me, you know, of how dangerous it was. You know, I was just a young lad, and I thought, well, you know, so as they say, about a week later, I thought it all, and I went down and joined in Cardiff, the recruiting office.
Tell us about joining up then.
Well, sent to Portugalin, signed up at the Queen's Shilling, blah, blah, blah. Then they give a train ticket then from Bargoed to Abergavenny, Cardiff and Abergavenny. Got out at Abergavenny and they were meeting us with a Land Rover and just took us to Cotagotlin. And there were seven of us in the first batch in our platoon. And, you know, I knew a lot about what to do. I could do through being in cadets. How to bully your boots, press your clothes, and map reading and different things, you know what I mean? And got on all right, you know?
So which regiment did you join?
South Wales Borderers. Because I was in the second Mons, look, in the cadets, so you automatically went, well, it's the Royal Red, South Wales Borderers. Done the basic training. You see, you've seen the photo of our passing out parade, because some of them got back squatted because they weren't good enough. You know, but anyway, cut a long story short, that was it. And the next thing I knew, we were off to Hong Kong.
Did you join up on your own then?
Yeah.
Did you know anyone in the training platoon?
No, because they were all from different parts of South Wales. You know, but I remember we were doing drill on the square one day in Cotagotlin, right by the main road. I don't know if you've ever been there. And there's a long walk up to the guard room, and we're standing there having a cigarette break. And I looked down, and this bus stopped just outside the gate, the main gate. And this fella was walking up the road, now blonde hair, honest to God. And he had a case in his hand, and he was like this, marching up the road, right, to the guard room. Then a couple of hours later, now we found seen him again. And me and him were the best mates ever. Because he never been, knew nothing about the army. His father had been in the army, and his father had been captured by the Japanese. And anyway, that's another story, but me and him got out on like an house on fire. And he was a junior Mr. Wales bodybuilder, that's why he was walking like this, you know, his arms out. And never forget watching him just walking up the road. It was like, well, you know.
What's his name, eh?
Tom White, my best mate. And there he is, Ella. Just a second.
So look at this photo then. There was Tom White from Howard.
Pardon?
What? Where was he from?
Port Talbot. There he is.
They've got the white hair there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Blonde hair.
Yeah.
The Kraut, we used to call him. Tom White the Kraut.
So you went through training with Tom?
Yeah.
Well, tell us a little bit about training then.
Well, you had to do so much. I better back up now.
Sure.
Yeah. And we used to have to do drill a few times a week now, well, most days.
Yeah.
In the depot. And then you'd do assault courses, go up the ranges, then shooting, target shooting and all that. And then we go up towards Merthyr, from Crickowell, over the mountain, the Sugarloaf and different mountain, and just getting fit and everything.
And how long was the training?
I think it was 18 weeks. And yeah, we already enjoyed it.
What time of year was it?
What was it? I think it was... Wait a minute, I'll tell you now. Oh, I don't have my glasses now.
There's a set there.
Oh,
there's a set there.
Well, I joined the army on the 1st of the 2nd, 65, until 25th of the 6th, 65, so four months, and on the 26th of the 6th, then 65, went to Hong Kong, and
I ask you that, right, because training in February and March can be different to training in July and August.
Yeah. But I remember we had bloody snow there. Oh. And they give a hell of a lot of roads and that on the camp. And they had these boards made now, these square wood with an handle and a piece of sacking on them. And we started to clean the roads, pushing it down the bloody road to get the snow off the roads and that, like, oh, it was bloody hard work, but we done it. But, you just done it and that was it. Whatever you were told, you follow an order and that's it.
Did those 18 weeks change your personality?
Oh, definitely. Because it learnt you discipline. And that's what... I often say to my people, friends, you know, over the years, a lot of the trouble of the youngsters today and over the years, that there was lack of discipline in the home, and they were allowed to do what they wanted, when they wanted. But whereas I was from a big family, and my father was strict, but not over strict, but you never back-chatted or anything to my father or my mother, you know what I mean? You learnt that way because of my brothers, five boys, four brothers, and, you know, they'd bloody clip me around the ear for something, like, you know what I mean? But,
tell me, Howard, did you know you were going to Hong Kong?
Yeah. Yeah. Because the borderers, the South Wales borderers, were already in Hong Kong, look. He'd been stationed out there for quite a few months. And, well, we were sent there, landed at Kai Tak, and I went up to Stanley Fort, which was the main camp, the main base camp on Hong Kong. Well, it was the only one on Hong Kong Island.
17?
17 and a half.
So, tell me about a little bit about the impression.
Well, you are. We'd done training then, look. Yeah. Right? And on the 4th of December, we flew down to Borneo. Right? So my birthday was on the 21st of December, look.
Yeah, we'll come back to that in a minute.
In the training camp.
In the training camp, yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm interested in... So, there's a 17 and a half year old boy from Bargoed. Hasn't been out of Wales. All of a sudden, he lands in Hong Kong. What was your first impression?
Oh, what a place. What a place. It's, you know, because... Well, it's totally different, isn't it? You know what I mean? It's you'd see things that you'd never seen before. Do you know what I mean? You think, well, what's going on here? Like, you know what I mean? That type of thing. But you know, we used to go down into Hong Kong most weekends. If we were not on duty, you'd finish on a Friday, and then come back on a Sunday night, ready. Ready for Monday morning to be on parade.
What was your duties in Hong Kong then?
Sorry?
What was your duties in Hong Kong?
Well, we were there as peacekeeping because they had riots there. We had our own riot squad. And one thing I remember was, you know, have you heard of the Star Ferry in Hong Kong? It's a ferry going between Hong Kong and Kowloon, it's straight back and forth. And the government put the price up. Now, the Hong Kong dollar was worth 1 and 3 pence when we were there. And they put it up an 1/2. You know, and it riots every bloody way over it. And we've got to go down into town then and sort it all out, like, you know.
What did the riot look like to you?
Oh, it was... People charging at you, and you know, your shields and buttons, and you know what I mean. It was a learning curve, you know what I mean. And I remember another time when in Hong Kong, the city, there was a big dam up on top of a mountain, and we had such a typhoon and everything, and we had to go down. That the dam burst. And it was on a hill, and there was cars now parked both sides of the hill and a couple of roads, and the cars were pushed down into the town, and what we had to do was go and get the bodies out of there because the people had drowned. And we had the Royal Court Transport there with JCBs, and we were putting the bodies in the bucket, the front bucket of a JCB, like, to be taken away.
Oh my word.
And it was such a washing. We had rubber boots, you know, the army boots on. And you know the traffic islands with the two lights? You'd walk on there and you would feel electric go through your feet. Honest to God, it's crazy, you know. That was an experience again, you know what I mean? First time we'd ever handled a body or whatever, you know what I mean? And but we'd done it and that was it. You know?
So how did you manage to cope with those feelings about that as boys together?
Well, I don't know, Neil, what it's like in the Air Force, but the Army, you had to have a good sense of humour. And there were things you'd say without being, you know, to make each other laugh and forget about what you're doing. Do you know what I mean? It was... banter.
Sort of a black sense of humour.
Yeah.
To cope.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, if we were thinking about it all the time, you'd never bloody do it. Do you know what I mean? You've just got on with it and...
So what did you boys do to relax on the weekends then?
Down into Hong Kong on the pop. From Friday to Sunday.
Really?
Because they say the Hong Kong dollar was 1 and 3 pence. Well, we weren't on bad money. Well, it wasn't bad money. It was bloody awful. But we managed, like. And we got a truck down into Hong Kong on Friday afternoon. And then a bus back on the Sunday. So,
at that time, late 60s, mid 60s, yeah, there was a lot of American military in Hong Kong.
You had to bring that up, didn't you? You had to bring that up.
Tell us about the Americans in Hong Kong.
Well, every 2 weeks, the Vietnam War was going on then, right? And they would come there now from Vietnam. They'd be down there for months and months and months. And they never had any, you know, money while they were in Vietnam, but what they had, they couldn't get for nothing. But then when they come to Hong Kong, they'd all have $100 bills in rolls like that, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And there was this club called, for the Americans, called the China Fleet Club. And, I'll tell some stories about that. But, I got photos in there of some of the Americans. We used to have a drink with them, you know what I mean? And even a couple of fights, like, you know what I mean? But,
you mentioned in a previous conversation about the Americans flying back.
Oh, yeah.
When tell us about that.
Well, Kai Tak Airport was out into the sea. And it had a butt end on it. Once, you know, as the airplane would take off, it would take off and there was nothing there to, for it to land or if anything happened. It was straight to sea. And they reckon, subsequently, that they overloaded the plane. And this plane went over straight, couldn't get off the ground, and just went into the sea off the end. Well, you had to get the Royal Court Transport down with the landing craft and different boats and that to sort it out, like, you know, because you've got luggage and everything and everything floating in the water. Well, you know, every one of them died.
Who was on the plane?
American soldiers going back to Vietnam.
Did you have any involvement in that?
No. No.
But interesting story, yeah. Backstory. Yeah. So boom. Why Borneo? What was happening? You were in Hong Kong, how come we ended up in Borneo?
Yeah, well, I was gonna say to you now. We'd been there about 8, 9 weeks, 10 weeks, 12 weeks, something like that. And the DLI were in Borneo.
DLI?
Durham Light Infantry. And they asked if we could supply them with a platoon of men, because they were short in this one area near the border.
Just tell me what was going on in Borneo at the time.
Well, it was Indonesia, and the Chinese wanted to take over Malaya, rule of Malaya, and British North Borneo, to make it a complete washing for them, for the Indonesians and the Chinese. And there was only us sent there, British soldiers, Australians, New Zealanders, Gurkhas, you know, and it was a vast area that we had to cover. And I got a book there with photos in of the area, and it's hundreds of thousands of miles long, the border between British North Borneo and Indonesia.
Was it a standoff or was there conflict going on?
Oh, conflict all the time. All the time. Yeah.
So the South Wales Borderers were asked to go and support the light infantry, so how did you get involved with that then?
Well, because it was a borderer, and they would give us an all, you know, duties to do. To go up onto the border, as they say, with ration packs, you would say on the on a Friday or whatever, knew me well what day it was. Right, boy, we're off at the border tomorrow. I need to see you with so many ration packs for how many days we're going out, 10 days or 12 days, whatever. And we used to swap things between each other. If you didn't like something and I did, we'd swap something, you know what I mean? And we used to have to carry extra rounds of ammunition and different things. And, you know, you had a big pack on your back. And you walk through the jungle for about 5 or 6 hours. And then you start to climb up the mountain to get onto the top of the border. And it was, as you say, it was a rainforest. And you'd be walking, trying to climb this mountain, and your feet would just sink into the mud. And you'd pull yourself up, and it used to take you at least 3 or 4 hours again to get up on top of the border. Well, it would be then just getting dark, about 4:30. Every day the same, and the rain would come then, in the jungle, and you had to sort yourself out then, and then it'd be time to stand to, which was men both sides of the border standing to make sure there's no enemy coming up behind us or whatever. And have to get up and do stag then. And we always carried a set of dry clothes with us because it was a rainforest. And that was the worst bloody part of it, was because you were soaking wet, and what you had to do was make a bivvy, two of you in a bivvy. You'd have a ground sheet on the floor and then one over the top, and two of you would share that. And you'd have to strip off outside the bivvy. Grab your dry clothes out of a plastic bag in your pack, get into it, and then get down to sleep or rest, you know what I mean, and then sleep. And then four or five hours later they'd call you, well, not call you, but they would knock, you know, get hold of you to go and do your stag, which was 2 hours on, 4 off. So what you had to do then, when you come off that stag, before you went on the stag, you had to put your dry clothes back in the bag, in this plastic bag, and put the wet clothes back on, and do your stag, come back, chuck the wet clothes off again, get into the dry clothes, and it went on like that all the time. So, you know, it's
if I could rewind you a little bit, because I know that you didn't just end up in Borneo. Something, when you were in Hong Kong and the message came through, the request from the DLI, your platoon commander,
Brian Titchborne, yeah,
did a little bit of a selection process, didn't he?
Yeah.
And you boys had to work hard.
Oh, bloody right we did.
Well, tell us about that then.
Well, it was not only him, it was Dad Morgan. He was a sergeant, and the platoon sergeant, and he was in his late 30s. Brian Titchborne was about 26, I think, something like this. And they really worked us, because when we were in Hong Kong, because we used to have to carry a pack and run around the mountains of Hong Kong doing different things just to get fit. Well, as I say, I tried to show a photo of when we were in training. There he is, look at his phone.
Fit, strong and healthy.
Oh, damn I.
Before you went to Borneo.
Yeah. You are, look.
There you are.
That's what I would like when we was in training. Not a bad body on me, if I say so myself. But some of the photos then, when we were in Hong Kong, in Borneo, we were reduced to that, look. See how thin it was? And
yeah, it's very thin.
You know?
Yeah.
We all lost about 2 stone, yeah. 2 stone or 2.5 stone yeah. In weight.
So, you were in the training in Hong Kong.
Mm.
there were helicopters involved?
Yeah, but as I say, that Hugh's name, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So Hugh, the helicopter off the Ark Royal, and we had to do rope training and different things, you know. And we were on the football field.
Why did you have to rope training?
Well, because if you was in the jungle, the only way you could get out was by helicopter. You know, if you were injured or whatever, you know, all he wanted supplies, he'd ferry him in by helicopter, you know.
So it was easy really then, you were choppered into Borneo, no walking involved.
You're having a laugh, I know.
Well, tell me then.
Wherever you went in the jungle, but you had to walk, because there's no bloody roads or tracks, you know, there's only just bare tracks. But we started going different places every time we went out. No, because the Gurkhas would move up somewhere, and the Australians or the New Zealanders would be, you know, different parts, just to keep the border occupied all the time.
Did anyone get hurt during those walks?
Yeah. Yeah.
How?
We got caught in an ambush. Well, we didn't. The DLI walked into an ambush on one young lad, Tommy Griffiths, 18 years of age, got killed. And we had to, because the DLA had gone over the border to do a recce, do a operation, and they walked in on an ambush, and they got a bit of a sticky end, you know. And one young lad, Tommy Griffiths, was killed. And he had to come through, he had to fetch his body through our position to have an helicopter land and take his body. And there was another guy was shot in the shoulder. And he had to take them cars of Akram out, you know, out of the jungle.
What was the feeling in your platoon when that happened?
Eh?
What was the feeling like for you boys?
Well, we thought, you know, it's hard to understand, Neil, because you knew you were in an hot spot, and you were on your nerves every day when you're going out on patrol or whatever, you know what I mean? And it's like one day we were on the border, and it's Billy Ackerman was on guard, even another guy, and we had a GPMG each end of our stretch of the border, and it's Billy Ackerman, you heard something crashing through the jungle or up in a tree like, and he opened up with a GPMG, and what had happened, he found out the next morning. We had to stay awake then all night, right, and everybody called him whatever they wanted to do after we found out what it was. But it's bloody orangutan, they make a nest up in the trees. And this one had fallen out of the bed it had made and come crashing down to the ground. And he never shot it, it just frightened it and it ran away. But they found air, or the Iban tracker, or these people, the indigenous people who used to lead it, they knew all the junk, where to go, what to do and whatever. And he said, yeah, old man of the jungle.
I've never been in the jungle.
Oh.
So.
You want to go? It's an experience.
Well, describe to me what it's like for an 18-year-old, you know, what does it smell, what does it sound like, you know?
It was constant sound, day and night. Birds singing, birds, you know, making noises, monkeys making noises, when we were walking through the jungle, you had snakes wrapped around trees, and it, you know, you could just walk past them like that. You know what I mean? And there were spiders. There were scorpions. There was red ants, black ants. And honestly, God, you'd swear it was a river. Well, in some parts where these ants were moving, and it was like a stream. So wide. like a river going, you know, through the jungle. You have to step over them, and you know, it was.
So, you were based in a camp.
We had the main base camp.
Yeah.
Where the DLA were stationed. And we used to have to go up onto the border, and the boys made different parts to the platoons, which would go to different parts. And they'd stay out 10 days or whatever, 14 days, whatever. All depending on what was going on, you know.
What was your camp like then?
Well, just a basic, well, it was sandbags. And what it was, it had been built, it was left over from the last war. Because, it, you know, Burma and all that, and they were all sandbags built. And we had to, I haven't got any photos there now. Oh, yeah, yeah. There they are. That's the base camp.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the base camp. But they were made, built during the last war by British soldiers.
Yes, yes.
There's the Ebon trackers and the people, the indigenous people.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you sleep then?
Eh?
Where did you sleep?
We had luxury bed.
Oh.
We had these little camp beds to sleep on instead of the bloody ground. But, you know, yeah, look, that's typical of where we were sleeping under there.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel safe in camp?
Well, yeah, because there was guard posts all around the camp, look. You know what I mean? And with punji sticks in the jungle, if they were coming up the hill, the punji stick would be facing out this way. You get caught in them, like, you know what I mean?
You mentioned before about the parachutes and what they were used for.
Yeah, well, that's what I said, tell him here, what I said about the indigenous people down in the village. We'd give them a parachute, the women, and he'd make silk for us to sleep in, not getting bitten by mosquitoes.
Luxury silk
parachute? Oh, yeah. Oh, hey, we didn't hang about that. We had a row for doing it, but...
Did you?
Damn, man. Didn't give it up.
So, what do you do for water, then?
Go to the river.
Okay. Tell us how
Well, it's like when we was up on the border. Every two or three days, it'd be four or five of us would have to climb, go down the mountain, carrying five or six or seven water bottles tied together from each man, you know, one from each man. And we used to have to go down the mountain, fill it up with water from the river, find the nearest river, and when he got back up the top, then he'd put his tablets in there, the water cleansing tablets.
Mm.
And it tasted bloody horrible, you know.
Mm.
And but it's what he had to do.
All the time, this was a conflict situation.
Yeah, yeah.
So you had to take your weapons with you.
Oh yeah, well that's what I say, the only thing you had was the water bottles and your rifle, you know.
Mm.
And go down the mountain. We knew roughly where the river was. I'd fill them up, you know, and just put them back together and then climb back up.
So at one time, you told me before that you boys were sent up to protect a helicopter pad.
Yeah, well, actually saying when that boy Tommy got killed.
Well, tell us about what happened when you were shelled.
Well, that was another thing on an helicopter landing pad. They had that, it's part of the same thing of where that young lad got killed and his mate got wounded. They'd gone over the border to Dunop against the Indonesians, and then they got caught and whatever, and they'd come back up through our position. Well, we had to wait then to give them plenty of time to get out, because the helicopter couldn't take them all, you know, just get back to base camp as quick as possible. Well, after about half an hour, we were just making our food because we thought it was all over, and all of a sudden he just started shelling us. And within about 25-30 minutes, we had 57 shells land around us, around the helicopter landing pad. I see, if one of them shells had landed in the middle, we'd have all been obliterated. You know, but blowing the trees down like matchsticks, you know.
Tell me what that sounds like.
Oh, you don't want to do. We were there like this on the ground, Neil. Just laying flat in the middle of this helicopter landing, part with your head down. And, you know, just waiting every couple of seconds for a shell to land. And there was some boy shouting out, you know, or crying out, Mom, 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 or whatever, you know what I mean? They were frightened that much. And, it lasted about 30 or 40 minutes. And what we had to do then was gather our kit together and then get the hell from there. You know what I mean? Because they could have been coming up behind them, behind the shells, you know what I mean?
Who was it that was shelling you then?
The Indonesia.
Artillery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that photo I got by there, the one of me sitting on the gun, that's the one that was in the base camp. And every night, the Royal Artillery would pick out certain areas, or the colonel of the regiment, or the officer would say, right, we shell you tonight, shell there tonight, shell there tonight. And they knew where the paths were, or the coordinates of the different paths and different things. And he'd send about 10, 12 shells off in on one lane, and then he'd turn it around and then, you know, just keep firing in.
When you moved out from that position, what was that like?
When, no.
When you got, after you got shelled,
yeah.
You said you had to get your pack together.
Yeah.
What was that like getting out of there?
Very fast. Very, very fast, let me tell you. Because we knew that platoon commander was counting them. Every shell that landed, and it was, they say, 57 shells within half hour, just over half an hour, three quarters an hour. And you just didn't move. And once they stopped, he said, right, come on, let's go. And we'd all chuck our stuff in our packs and get going. You know what I mean? And we were like bloody rabbits going through there, I tell you now. But it was some experience.
That was a significant event in the whole war, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We were the only platoon, right, for the DLI or other regiments that got shelled. The only platoon. I used to say, oh, bloody Indonesians, you hate the Welsh. You know what I mean? Laughing it off, you know what I mean? And it's just something that happened, and you just got on with it. You know what I mean? But as you say, we were all frightened, and I bet any man that said he wasn't frightened is a bloody liar, you know?
Back to camp?
Yeah, back to base camp.
Routine kicks in again?
Yeah. The only place we could have a shower, because they had built showers there, you know what I mean? And proper toilets and whatever, not proper toilets, but holes in the ground, you know? And, you know, there's good wheat, decent food instead of ration packs, you know what I mean?
So, your tour went on, so how long were you on, you were deployed in Borneo, how long for?
5 months. And we still have to go out every week, for 10 to 4, well, every other week or whatever, you know what I mean, you'd have a few days off in base camp, and, you know, you've done 10 or 12 days up on the jungle, up on the border or whatever.
Tell me about the toll that took on you physically.
Well, you can see by their photos, isn't it, you know what I mean? As I say, we all lost. Every one of us lost about 2.5 stone through just eating ration pack.
And then what was that condition, skin condition?
Oh, actinic keratosis. Well, not actinic keratosis, they called it tinea. And it was like a foot rot. And you had, like, from there down, They were all like little circles, like a ringworm. All, and that's how they used to paint it. Well, on that one photo, because his shirt was wet and he was rubbing it, we could see where Les and I were doing that, putting our barbed wire up. And look, it's in the coloured photo, look. See it there on me? Yeah?
So when you, what happened then? So you finished your tour. How did you get back to, did you go back to Hong Kong or straight back
to
UK?
Back to Hong Kong, yeah.
When you got back to Hong Kong, what happened?
Nothing. We weren't debriefed or anything. Nobody gave us, asked us this or asked us that, how we got on. And but they knew what we'd gone through because the platoon commander made a report every week. And I think we had 10 days off. And then just doing back to basics with in Hong Kong.
Wow.
And then we came back then to Lydd in Kent, and what did we do then? Oh, that's right, the next thing we had, about a month later, had to go to Botswana in Africa to guard a BBC relay station in Francistown. And we sent them out for 4 months, supposed to be, but we only done two, because they called us back then to go from Botswana to Aden. And that was another story.
That was another story, Howard, that's quite right. And I think it might be an idea. Do you want to have a break there, Hugh? And
can do, yeah.
It's a real good natural break, that, because I think we've got a lot in on Borneo there.
Yeah. 47 minutes.
Yeah. Okay, Howard, so you were brought back from Botswana, and the next thing, there was a crisis in the Middle East going on.
Yeah, Aden, yeah.
What was Aden about?
Oil.
Okay.
And it was a very handy place to have a base from going east to west and whatever, you know, there's a big port.
Aden was a port.
Yeah. And oil terminals and everything there, you know. Mm-hmm. And there was Flossie, the Freedom for Liberation of South Yemen. And I can't think of the name of the other lot. But what it was chiefs of different groups.
Yeah.
Trying to get the you could do, you know, get the most out of it then, you know what I mean? They were fighting each other on us. And it was a dirty war, because they just didn't give a damn, you know, what they done or what they didn't do, you know what I mean? It's
why was Britain involved with Aden?
Because of the oil.
What control did Britain over Aden at the time?
Well, because they had, the BP was there, look.
Right, British Petroleum.
Yeah, and they had oil tankers, oil washings there, you know, what do you call them, big...
Refineries.
Refineries and that, yeah.
So in essence, Aden was controlled by Britain at the time?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so how did you become involved in that conflict then?
Well, we were told to go there, and there we went, you know what I mean? And we started to go on patrol twice or three times a day.
How did you get to Aden then?
Flew. Pretty heavy, mate, but...
Royal Air Force?
Yeah.
And can you, what date was that then?
Stickler for punishment, really.
I'm going easy on you.
I know you are, bud. Length of the first 67. Until... What was it? 11th of 1967.
So 9 months out in Aden.
Yeah.
Were you posted as a platoon, a regiment, or
battalion?
Battalion.
Yeah, the old battalion was there.
What was the brief?
Royal Regiment of Wales then, because we'd amalgamated with the Welsh Regiment. And we were called the Royal Regiment of Wales.
So, did you know why you were being sent there?
No, because nobody bloody told us. No, it was, you go in here. And basically our duty was to work on Marla Main, which is the main street through Aden, from Steamer Point up to, what do you call it? Crater, where Martin Mitch was. And our job was to look after the families of the Air Force, the Army, the Navy, and whatever. And it was our duty to try and keep those families safe from terrorists.
And how did you do that?
Well, we just have to escort the children from and the parent and the mother to from the out, from the flat or whatever, outside the flat to the bus stop to take the children to school and different things. You know, it was when the mothers went shopping, we'd be on patrol in the area. You know.
What did those patrols look like?
Well, it would be 10 of you or 12 of you. And you'd have, like, two sides of the road. And you'd be one there, one there, one there, one there, one there, one there. And you'd be up looking at the blocks of flats or the buildings and, you know, having grenades thrown at you. Opening up with Kalashnikovs, mortars, whatever. And it was... it was hard and frightening, but you know, you just had to do what you had to do. And if you killed somebody, you killed somebody, and that was it. You know, if somebody threw a grenade or whatever. So, you know, you just had a job to do and you did it. To try and protect the families who were on both blocks of flats, both sides of Marla Main. And, you know, the husbands were working down in RAF Camaxa, and not Camaxa, what was it? Yeah, RAF Camaxa, and Steamer Point, the Navy part. And they, you know, we had to look after the families while they were doing their job. And that was it, you know. And we used to carry out raids on our the Arab terrorists, because you had informants would say, look, there, that house, there, that flat, this building, whatever. And we had one guy, I can't think of what it was, but he used to come down Marla Main in a taxi with a Kalashnikov in the boot, right? And he'd go down the road in Marla Main, and he turned left up a road, turned left again, and there was a big wall there of a building, like a yard or whatever, and he would come out onto what they call Gunman Knoll. And what it was just a patch of earth, a mound of earth, and he would get the gun, the Kalashnikov off, because we had observation posts on top of the blocks of flats, so, right? Every so often. And you'd be up on there looking out over the squatters area. You had tin shacks to live in. And the Arabs. And he would come there, didn't know when he was going to come there or whatever. But then all of a sudden you'd hear this Kalashnikov going off and it'd zing, zing, zing over your head. Well, you'd get down in behind the wall up on top of the flats. And by the time you got back up, then he had gone, look, in the taxi, back down the road, back, I'm coming up Marla Main. Nobody knew who he was, look. But we had him in the end. We had him in the end.
Did he hurt anyone?
We killed a few.
Did he?
Yeah.
What, soldiers?
Yeah. On top of the blocks of flats.
So he was a prime target, really?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Mm. Definitely. Mm. And in one incident, there was two RAF guys just down the road from where we were based, or where we were staying. Just down around the corner of the garage. And these two RAF guys pulled in there to fill up with petrol. And this guy turned up on a motorbike, bang, 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 and drove off. Now, they had him weeks and weeks later, and he was a German bloody mercenary. German mercenary working for the Arabs.
What happened to those two RAF guys?
Well, they were killed straight away. Two rounds in the head. And we had to go down and get them out, like, and sort things out.
Oh, you went to the scene?
Oh, that too. It was only just down around the corner from where we were staying, look. But you could hear the shots. Yeah. But,
So in the thick of it, really?
Well, we was right in the thick of it because I was the main road through Aden, look. So and it was, if you're going to understand, as you go down Marla Main, the ones on the left were looking out onto the crater mountains, and there was tin shacks everywhere for these Arabs families to live. And it was a right squalid place, you know.
Where were you staying then?
In a youth hostel place. A building with rooms in. And we sleep tent to a room or whatever, you know. And we had bunks, you know, in the bedroom. And we said, go down in and just go out through the door and down the road and start your patrol, you know.
What did a normal day look like in Aden for you then?
Well, you get up in the morning and after coming off stag again on top of these blocks of flats, and you'd have your food, have your breakfast, and you start out on patrol about 6-7 o'clock in the morning, just as everything is starting to move around, like. And you were living on your nerves all the time because you didn't know where the hell the grenades were coming from, because there were walls with these buildings, and they'd lob a grenade over the wall and disappear. Well, there's one guy in the photos I've got in there, Frank Lawrence. I wasn't on his patrol, I was on another one. And somebody shouted grenade. He got down in the gutter, and his bloody grenade had rolled into the gutter, and the base plate was facing towards him. You know, a base plate on the bottom of a grenade? Mm-hmm. Went, caught him right in the backside and up into his stomach. But he survived. They worked on him for days and days and days. And he was in hell of a mess. And when they flew him home, they had to stop off at one of the Arab countries. I forget where it was now. From Aden. And they had to operate on him again there to keep him alive. And then he flew him into England, like.
So when you're going out on patrol then, what are you looking for?
Any bloody thing is moving, or anything, your eyes and your head is everywhere. You know what I mean? Or you don't just walk. It's this, that, you know, all round. And everybody would be doing the same thing. And if they seen anything flying through the air, they'd shout grenade and down you had to bloody get. You know what I mean? And it happened quite a number of times, but nobody got injured. But sometimes people did. You know?
Did you have any interaction with the locals?
No. Weren't allowed to. The only thing we had to do was if they'd done something wrong, do what we had to do. You know? Because, you know, they were just, terrible people. They just didn't get, a life meant nothing to them. A human life meant nothing to them. Do you know what I mean? And I say about a young lad from Crumlin in South Wales. He'd only been in the battalion about 3 weeks, and he was up on top of one of these observation patrol posts, and he was up there on guard with a couple of other guys, and this bloody gunman on Gunman Knoll opened up and had him through the neck, killed him straight away, 18 years of age.
You remember his name?
I got it somewhere. I can't think of it. But there was a mate of mine, Ginger Hughes, lived in Crumlin, and he knew the mother and father because I met him down in the miners' rest home in, where is it? A couple of years ago. And he was in the we were in the same regiment, I'd go in the same platoon. And he knew the mother and father.
So a young boy,
18-year-old
boy from South Wales.
Yeah, from Crumlin.
Okay. What was the climate like there then?
Very hot. It was in the 30s all the time. 30 degrees all the time. But that's how I got all this on me, look. This actinic keratosis.
Tell me about that.
It's there, look, see it? Can you see it? It's a skin complaint. And it's through heat, being heat all the time. And I got on my back, I got on my arms, you know. And I tried everything. I beat a cancer specialist down in Glangwilly. And it's all they do is put cream on it. But it just doesn't work. You know what I mean?
But that's from your time in Aden.
Yeah.
So, how would you dress then to go out on patrol?
Pair of shorts, shirt, beret, and boots, and that was it.
Carrying a rifle.
Yeah. Oh, you had to sleep. Well, like in Borneo, I told you before, when we used to get down in the night to go to sleep, you slept with that rifle in between your legs, in a, you know, just to make sure.
Ammunition?
Yeah.
So we were carrying a lot?
Not in Borneo. Well, we used to have to carry extra bullets, ammunition, in case we did have problems, but where, you know, when we did, we did. And it's just one of the things, you could have two full magazines when you go on patrol in Aden, because you never know what was going to happen, you know.
What time did you finish work on average day then?
Well, always about 5 o'clock. You know, it started to get dark then, you know what I mean? And you had your set meal times. So, that was it.
So, was there a routine around protection for the families at
night? Oh, yeah.
Tell us what that looked like then.
Well, you know, you had one platoon would go down one way, another platoon would go up another way. And then you'd have another platoon come that way, another one come this way. So there was always four platoons on Marla Main, on our section. And you just done the job that was there, like, to look after the families.
Was there a lot of vehicles? Or?
Oh, hell yeah. Well, it was the main road through Aden, look. From Steamer Point to, what did he say it was?
Crater,
yeah.
So did you see the ships coming in and out?
Oh yeah, and the planes and everything, you know what I mean? It's all right.
Busy?
Oh yeah, very busy. And you had a lot of Somalis there as well.
Oh, why?
Because they were fishing there, look. And they used to fetch drugs in and different things.
Oh,
the Somalis.
God.
Yeah.
Did you get involved with that kind of policing? Or?
No, I was left to the Royal Military Police. And, the Royal Military Police were everywhere, you know what I mean, on different jobs.
So it was a tough old time for you as a...
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Were you about 19 then?
19. 21.
Matter of interest, when you were operating in Aden, were you with the same platoon you were in Borneo with?
Yeah, most of us. We all stuck together, look. Do you know what I mean? We had the odd one or two that had dropped out, but basically it was the same platoon.
Did that help?
Oh, darn man, because you knew we'd been through Borneo, we watched each other's backs, and we knew what to do. Do you know what I mean? Like it was a band of brothers, isn't it? Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
We all knew what each other was thinking, and we used to have the banter and whatever, but, you know.
And how did that feel to have that?
Oh, comradeship, yeah. Definitely. Definitely. You know, we give up each other's life for each other, like. You know what I mean?
Is that a good memory?
Oh, bloody right. Yeah. Yeah. Once you went out on patrol, you knew you were safe. You know?
Relatively.
Yeah, relatively. But, didn't always work. You know what I mean?
Are you still in touch with any of your...
Yeah.
Yeah,
well,
that's
good. Well, especially Tom White. I ring him every fortnight. And we have a bit of banter on the phone, and as I say, I haven't been for 2 years, but I go to Brecon, to Derrin Lines, for the annual reunion.
Mm-hmm.
What's your thoughts on Aden?
Place I'd never want to go again, Neil. Place I would never ever want to go again. Because of what happened, you know. But as they say, the Arabs, a life means nothing to them.
So you spent 9 months, huh?
Yeah.
How did that come to an end then?
Well, the war was over then. The trouble was over. And Britain pulled out, look. And we were one of the last regiments to go out of there.
So did you boys help with the evacuation then?
No, so all we had to do was make sure our equipment was right and whatever, and just go down to the airport and jump on a plane and off we go. Do you know what I mean? We just told 1 day, well, 2 days before, right, we're off home now, day after tomorrow, and we had to have everything ready and, you know, sorted. And
how did that feel when you were told you're going home? Explain.
Well, it was a relief because of what we'd gone through. You know, we've seen people, bodies everywhere, and lots of bodies and different things, you know. It was just... Do you remember that song, "We Gotta Get Out of This Place"?
The Animals.
The Animals. That record was on the Army radio station at least 4 or 5 times a day of our boys. Say, play it again. "We Gotta Get Out of This Place." And it was just a bit of banter, like, you know what I mean? But it was a terrible place, honestly. You wouldn't believe it. You would not believe it.
So what happened then? So you came back to the UK, did you get leave or...?
Yeah, we had 2 weeks leave. And funny enough, we went back to Lydd in Kent. And after that, then we... 1966, we came back from Borneo. Our platoon was picked to go on the official opening of the Severn Bridge, the first Severn Bridge for the Queen, and we had to do a bit of a guard of honour for her, like, didn't we? And months later then, we had to go up to Windsor Castle to do guard duty. You know, it was just unbelievable, you know?
Contrast.
Yeah.
How did it feel then? Tell us a little bit about doing Windsor Castle.
Well, basically, just doing guard duty, Neil, you know, I don't know if you've ever seen, the back of Windsor Castle, you've got a long road, right? It's about a mile and a half long, I think it is, in the park. And if you look back at it, the building, there was two guard boxes there. Well, we were standing them all most of, well, for 2 hours every night or whatever, or you know, just do guard duty during the day, changing the guard and all that. You know what I mean? It was worthwhile, you know, because with all the people are there and standing by you and taking photos, and you know, it's
Is that a proud moment for you?
Oh yeah, definitely. You know, we were like as good as the Welsh Guards then. So we thought. You know what I mean? But it was just one of them things, isn't it? Mm. You know what I mean?
Looking back now, before I look back and recap, so you've come back now, you've had your 2 weeks R&R. So what happened then for you?
From where now?
Right, so you come back from Aden.
Yeah.
Right. Landed back in the UK. You've had your 2 weeks R&R.
Yeah, at home.
What happened for you then?
Well, I just went back to Kent. Lived in Kent. And, well, that was it. We just done what we had to do. Well, they sent us to Cardiff then when the opening of the Severn Bridge. It was part of the opening of the Severn Bridge. And they bussed us up to Newport then, just outside Chepstow, to do a guard of honour for the Queen. And then months later then it was up to Windsor, from Lydd in Kent to Windsor to do guard duty there. Because the Welsh Guards had gone to, where did he gone to? He'd gone somewhere, I forget where the Welsh Guards were supposed to be there, but they sent them off. I can't remember where they went, but we had to go there then to do the guard duty, you know.
So how long was it then that you arrived back, did the guard duty and what have you, before leaving the army?
Well, I left in 71. You know, I'd done 6 years with the regiment, and then I'd done further 6 years with the in the reserve. I'd done seven years in the reserve after I come out the army. I meant I could have been called up any time, you know what I mean? We've done 12 years, 32 days, 323 days.
So what made you leave then?
Because I've had enough.
Of?
Well, between Borneo and Aden, you know. Because Ireland was coming up then as well. I thought, well, it's not going to be a third time lucky for me, pal. I'm out. Do you know what I mean? Because
mm-hmm.
I knew what was going on over there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And,
looking back now at your 12 years and how many days, what's your thoughts on your service then?
I done my best. That's all I can say. I done, if they told me to do a job, I'd do a job. And, you know, that's what I had the Queen's shilling for, to serve my country and to serve and do my bit. Do you know what I mean?
I've seen you before. Laying a wreath at the War Memorial on Remembrance Sunday. What do you think of on Remembrance Sunday?
Well, when me and Peter were there, when I remember Peter came with me, didn't he?
Yeah.
To lay the wreath. And I stood there only for a minute or two, wasn't it? And you always think of the ones you lost. Mates you've lost or whatever, you know what I mean? And it's just, it's just thinking of those that have gone past, have gone, you know what I mean? And I lost a few mates in the army, in our regiment. And that was it, you know, it just,
yeah.
Think of them.
That's a really good way to end the interview, I think, because, you know, remembering the boys that did come home. With Aidan there's a lot of detail we could go on.
Oh, yeah.
Because you've given a flavour of what it's like, but clearly, you know, anyone listening to that will get some idea that, crikey, you know, but what's difficult for people to understand is, like, these are young lads. These aren't, like, 35-year-olds,
serious
hardened veterans, you know. So, yeah, thank you, Howard. That was really interesting.
No problem. Glad to be here.